morning, everybody, and welcome back to another riveting episode of Fingers Crossed Podcast. We are your hosts, here for a good time, not a long time, hopefully not too long of a time, because we could talk for hours, but we're going to try not to. I'm Christy.
I have to leave for San Diego in a little bit, so I probably can't be too long of a time anyway. I'm Sierra. Hey, guys, welcome back to the show. We are so happy to have you for today's episode. It is our second ever official book club.
We did our first book club. I feel like we need a jingle. We still haven't gotten any sort of jingles.
We say this, take a damn shot every time we talk about jingles that never get happened. Those jingles. Anyway,
we're recording this bright and early on a nice Saturday
morning. So early. Yeah, we're doing Saturday morning session. We were up. I was up late. Christy was probably up late. Christy was up late, the narrator says. But today, book club, our first book club we did over the summer was the
Defining Decade.
20 Survival Guide. What is it called?
The Defining Decade by Meg J.
The Defining Decade, which we enjoyed. Definitely was a good book to digest and discuss, but we had some, you know, liked it in, you know, take it with a grain of salt, some things you didn't like. This book, as all books, I'm sure, is the same. You know, there are things I really like about it, things I like less about it, but what's great is it's so short. You can read the entire book in an hour.
And if you don't know what we're talking about, it's The Four Agreements by Don Miguel Ruiz.
Correct. The Four Agreements, a Toltec wisdom book, and it is in the self-help and discovery section at Barnes & Noble. It's also at Target.
Thank you for the direction there.
You can read it in an hour. So if you're listening to this podcast and you're like, oh, shoot, it's book club and I haven't read this book, you could literally pick it up today and finish it today.
And then listen to the episode later today.
Yeah, exactly. Listen to it again. Listen to it now because you're already here. Ooh. But listen to it again later.
Very true.
Just so we get the clicks.
Points were made. Yes. I highly recommend this book because it is such an easy read. It's kind of like you don't have an excuse. You know, so many people are like, oh, I don't have time to read. Or how do you, you know, make time and blah, blah, blah. And it's like,
I say these things a lot. Yes. So you're not alone.
But I would say that this is a good place to start because I think it's good to start small with any sort of habit you're trying to get into. So if you're trying to break into reading in 2022, I would start with this book because it's good, like easy page turner. He makes it like really clear, breaks things down. And
he reiterates the same
underlying messages. Yeah.
Underlying again and again. So it's not like if you, you know, skim through one little section too fast, you've missed a giant point. Like it will be gone over again, which I do like. So it really hammers it in.
But it's not too repetitive either. So we'll get into that. But first, you guys are dying for our life updates, I'm sure, since the last time we spoke to you a week ago. What's going on in life? Now it's into, oh my God, guess what today is? January 15th. Guess what? She's actually going to guess. Sarah's the kind of person that if you say guess what, she's not just going to say what. She's going to sit there and think of the most very detailed guess that she could possibly think of that would land on January 15th.
January 15th.
It is the day that most people drop their New Year's resolutions. It is death to New Year's resolutions day. So if you made it and you're listening and you've still kept up with your goals and your resolutions from the first of the year, congratulations. You're in the minority. So congrats.
Well, you know, it's funny. I did break my dry January.
Okay,
so I have
there
to admit
you go.
That now.
You're in the majority of people.
But I broke it for one night, for a little wine night with some neighbors. And I just really wanted to participate. And so I was feeling guilty about it, but my neighbor was like, look, like it's not, you know, what you say, like, you know, it's progress, not perfection. If you want to do it. And then it doesn't mean you have to give up on it. So I was like, okay, great. And then I started again the next day.
Exactly. It's called damp January, which I believe in more than dry January because I think
damp January. I like it. It just sounds like a wet, moldy January to
accurate.
Me,
but it also, I think for anything that you do and you try and go like cold turkey of something that you enjoy doing or whatever, even if it's like unhealthy, if you're trying to get better at it, I think that it's good to not look at it in those like black and white terms. Like if I have one little thing, it's terrible. Like I think it's good to use dry January as a point of just evaluating where you actually enjoy drinking and like want to, and you're not just in habits of drinking a glass of wine on weekends. You know, like I think that's a good way to approach it. So I think it's totally fine that you had one glass when you wanted to spend the time catching up with your neighbors and stuff. Like there's no way to shame that. So,
and I mean, this book is going to tie into that perfectly. Just like the things we create shame around ourselves for, and the rules that we put to ourselves, because as I was thinking about it, reading this book, and you know, he even talks about this. I'll read this one little passage before we dive into it. That's like, if you fall, do not judge. Do not give your judge the satisfaction of turning you into a victim. No, be tough with yourself. Stand up and make the agreement again. Okay, I broke my agreement. I will start again.
Yeah.
But I like Damp January because it's like, again, I think it's just the consciousness. Yeah. You know, I was doing a lot of unconscious drinking, you know, just like, oh, I'm home from work, I'm going to have wine. It's like, I don't need to do that. Yeah. You know what I
exactly.
mean?
Exactly. And I think that's the best way to approach it in any sort of circumstance. I was actually talking about this with some friends at Friendsgiving in November because I have a few friends who had just like decided not to drink in November. And we were talking about it and we were all discussing like, if we had chosen to do that, what would be our motivation behind it? And it was so interesting just to like hear how different people have different reasons for doing that too. So I think it's all about the self-awareness of it because, you know, there were friends who were like, yeah, like I just had a habit of doing it. And I'm like, I was at dinner one time and I was ordering a drink and I didn't even want one. I was just like used to it. And that made me want to stop and just like, you know, whatever. And, but then he was like, but now that I'm at Friendsgiving, like I really want to drink with you guys and all these drinks that you guys made that were so good and everything. And it's like, okay, but that's a justified time, I would say. You know what I mean? Like, I think it's about having that balance of just like knowing what's worth it and what's just like part of your habits that don't really add to your life. Not that drinking is like a healthy thing to add to your life, but I think it's the kind of thing where it's the situation and, you know, if you're going to enjoy the memories with your friends, blah, blah, blah. And not that, and if you don't want to drink in that situation, you shouldn't force yourself to because your friends are. That's not what I'm saying. But it's about like actually getting at the root of what you want to do.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that, you know, just like having dessert or something like that, it should feel like a fun special occasion thing, not just like something you do to cope with the stress in your life, which I, you know, is a root of a larger problem. So it's just, it's very good to have those kind of awarenesses. And yeah, I was going to say something. Oh, financially also, it really was a slap in my face because normally if I go out to eat or dinner with a friend, we'll usually like get a margarita or glass of wine or whatever.
Yeah, like a drink or two.
I went out with my friend for dinner and I wasn't drinking, and she was, and we, at the bill at the end of the night, my bill was $12 and hers was $52.
Wow.
And I was literally like, oh my God, that is the kind of money you can spend if you just get water at a restaurant.
No kidding. No, it's so true. Like drinks have been more expensive than food sometimes. I went to this like visual art installation thing last night, which was super cool. It was like an not interactive. That's not the right word. Immersive, like light art experience. And they had a bar there. And they said something about, I don't know if I misinterpreted this, but they said something in the like intro thing that if you got a drink at the bar, there was like an interactive Pokemon Go experience with the drink. And so I was like, okay, okay, I got to do it. So I went and I got a drink, which was ended up being like over $20 for one.
Really?
Yeah. And that's like two meals. Like that's so ridiculous.
I know.
And I didn't even figure out the Pokemon Go situation. So that wasn't even worth it. But the drink was really good.
Oh.
And it was like a fun, you know, we're at this experience. Like I'm going to get a drink kind of thing. But what I'm saying is that those things add up quick. And
yeah,
especially when you get more than one at a restaurant when it's already like nice or something. Like, yeah, it's definitely a financial thing.
It's really crazy. Jason and I went to Cheesecake Factory last night and neither of us got drinks. We just got what? Like they have a lot of fun lemonades. We're like, well, we should still go out if we're not drinking. Let's just get like strawberry lemonades or something. So
they're still probably like $10.
Oh, they're like $4.95. Okay, but good, still, good. At least it's not the normal 14. Cocktails are like 16. Yeah, 14. So but we paid for our entire meal, like with an appetizer and everything on our gift card. And like normally that would never be the case.
Yeah,
so it was just nice. It was like a kind of like, okay, that's a fun little perk is you're actually saving a lot of money.
And exactly. I feel like there's so many reasons to do something like Dry January where you just kind of like it just points out things that you were had accepted like habitually, like the money, like, you know, maybe getting a little bit of a headache the next day if you had a couple glasses of wine, something like that. Like for me, the reason that I would give up alcohol for a month would be probably the health and just like going on a cleanse of it because it does take a toll on your body. And not that I'm out here like binge drinking every day or anything like that, but I definitely,
well, last July.
Okay, well, we're talking about this month, okay? Which I have been drinking probably more than usual this month too. So opposite of Dry January, but
wet January, very, very wet January.
God. Oh man. How's life besides your Dry January spell of whatever, you know?
Yeah. You know, sentences. That's not the only thing on my mind. It's a lot of it's job applications. Oh, yeah. Yesterday I discovered the whole, grouping of job applications that don't require a cover letter, and I was so stoked about it. like, yeah, on LinkedIn, they have, like, easy apply ones. Oh. And, like, even if I would, like, then go to the regular website, like, I would, you know, go to the actual job website, a lot of them didn't require a cover letter. It was literally just, like, you put in your resume, some information, and then you submit it, and then they'll reach out based on that. That's and I was nice. Like, okay, I can crank out, like, 6 of these in an hour. So that was really nice. I got a bunch of job apps in last night, which was good because I had spent the last few days about an entire day's worth of work on one job application. And that may sound crazy, but I'm not in great practice of writing cover letters. It's never something that, like, in my acting career or working for Disney or in restaurants or anything that I used to do that you really needed. Mm-hmm. You never had to write a cover letter. So I was a little out of practice with it, and I was feeling really frustrated because I'm like, I'm 26. I'm not like a, you know, fresh out of college grad, and yet I'm really struggling to write a cover letter. I'm really struggling with resume formatting. Mm-hmm. Like, these are things, especially when it comes to, like, looking, you know, in a corporate professional sense, because it's very different than everything I had experienced in that I was doing. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to understand that and have, you know, patience with myself, but I definitely was suffering from some frustration and, you know, just feelings of inadequacy with it, you know, that, like, I feel so behind when a lot of people are further ahead in that sense of career, you know, at a way younger age. But again, that's just, it's judgment based on a perceived notion of a rule in society, which is, again, will tie in perfectly to the book later that we will talk about. But I got a bunch in yesterday. That felt really good.
Sierra's been on it, you guys. She's been texting us this whole week, like, getting feedback on her cover letters and working on them and doing different drafts. And she's been, my book fell. She's been killing it, so I'm excited.
I've been trying, you know, it's I know you guys have, you know, I appreciate your opinions, and I've been getting feedback from Jason and stuff too, and really hoping for the best. A lot of the things I've applied to, I think I would be a great fit for. Like, I'm not even reaching for the stars too much. Like, I really think that some of these I would do very well at. I just need them to
feel the same.
Look at my stuff and give me a chance. Yeah, so mm-hmm. We shall see.
And that's always a good feeling, is finding the things where you actually feel like it's a good fit and not that you're just kind of, like, half-assing, throwing applications out there for the sake of it, you know? I mean, that's part of it, too. It's, like, throwing everything at the wall. But to throw things at the wall strategically, like, at a actual target dartboard and actually hit the dartboard and match up with the qualifications, it's a good feeling. So, excited for you.
But, Christy, I will say, I do hear your voice in my head a lot when I'm applying to things, and I'm... Just you saying, throw everything at the wall, see what sticks. Throw everything at the wall and see what sticks. Like, just hearing that, because I'm usually so selective of the things I apply to. Like, oh, well, if I don't have a chance of getting it, I'm not going to apply it. Or if I'm missing this qualification, I'm not going to apply it. Or if I'm missing, you know,
like, why say this no to yourself before you let them say no to you, you know?
Like, exactly. I'm going to let them reject me. Mm-hmm. I am not going to, but the wider net I cast, the better. And that, again, that may be easy for some people. It's very hard for me as someone who's like, I have to be perfectly qualified for everything that, like, is on this list. It has to be the perfect. But one job, I was like, this seems like an awesome job. I think I would do a great job at it. I'm missing this level of qualification, but I think I would do a great job of it. I'm going to apply. I'm going to do it. And then I just did it. And I was like, you know what? That did not harm me in any way. Exactly. I am not disintegrating. I'm not melting into the floor. Like, I am fine. And now I have a shot at this job that I wouldn't have if I didn't apply.
Yeah. And the worst thing that you're going to hear is no. And it might even be months down the road when you've already gotten a new job and forgot that you applied to that. I still get those. You guys, I legitimately... I remember, not that this is encouraging to hear while you're in this process, but I remember, like, I had been mad applying to things. This was, like, back when I lived in DC and I was applying to government jobs, and mm-hmm. I wasn't sure, like, where I was going to end up and stuff. And I applied to a bunch of stuff on, like, USA jobs, whatever, and forgot about them. This was a year and a half later. I had already gone through a whole cycle of another job and a contract that started and ended in the meantime. And I just happened to be in a job application phase, and I had been feeling so down and like, I don't know what I want to do. Like, this is before I kind of like found more of my groove with where I was going in my career and everything. And I just felt so down. And then I randomly got this rejection letter from a job I had applied to a year and a half earlier. That was like
a year and a half.
Yes.
Like, at that point, just don't knock down your damn door. Like, leave me alone.
Like, I wasn't waiting up for your answer, but yeah, it was just funny. But that's like also government stuff works like that a lot of the time, and the openings will be for like months at a time. But anyway, sorry, that was just a side note. But
no, that's, that happened with Jason too. He would get like, or people that like 6 months after he hired somewhere else, they'd be like, are you still interested in the position? It's like, bro, you're a little late.
Too little, too late. Exactly. But
yeah, call JoJo.
I feel you. I think it's good though, because it's good to keep multiple plates spinning and just applying to a bunch of things. And then you don't get as, you know, knocked down by the one that you get rejected from that maybe you're excited about, but you have other things that are also viable options. Mm-hmm. So
progress is coming about, and hoping for the best, and we'll just kind of taking it one day at a time. We'll see what happens.
Yeah,
but that's enough about me. What are you up to this weekend?
Today is Saturday morning, like we said, so tonight I actually need to get editing videos. I started posting videos again on YouTube. I finally pulled that barrier down, and it was actually so much easier than I thought. Like, I kind of talked about it in the video if you guys saw what I posted, but I just like had been building it up in my head that coming back on posting a video to YouTube was going to be this big hard thing, and then once I started talking and just like getting used to it, I was like, oh yeah, I know how to do this. Like, I'm fine. So it was really good. So I started vlogging again, and today I need to do some editing to get caught up, because that is part of the process, unfortunately, even though editing is not my favorite thing in the world. But I am gonna do that. I'm probably gonna have a chill afternoon, and then this evening we're having a little, I can say this because it'll be over by the time this is posted, not that he'd even be listening to this, but we're having like a little surprise birthday party for my friend Tyler. So he doesn't know what's happening. He has friends from out of town that are gonna be there. It's just gonna be like a chill little thing. And it's like cowboy theme. Yeah, Western. I still don't know what I'm going to wear because it is 20 degrees.
Well, I was going to say, bring back the Nashville outfit, but it's also not for 20 degrees. Well, can you wear like the top and the hat and the boots, but then just wear pants and a jacket?
What did I wear in Nashville again? Oh,
you wore like the pink sparkly skirt, the pink top, the pink hat.
The thing is, it's funny because I've somehow ended up at like a handful of cowboy themed occurrences since I bought that
well
hat.
That's the sign of a good 2021.
Yeah, that's true, I guess. But I actually wore this, I repurposed that outfit. I wore the skirt and everything when we were in Palm Springs because we had like a disco cowgirl night, but I don't think I'm gonna wear that because my butt was like half exposed and I don't want to be exposed in the 20 degree weather. So I don't know, maybe I'll just wear like, because my cowboy boots are white, so I'm trying to think of what pants would even look good with white cowboy boots.
Well, you know you can't wear white after Labor Day. That guy told you that one
true.
Time
I could
at a
never
bar.
Forget.
You guys have heard that story, but literally greatest story of all time when a guy at a bar yelled at Christy that she was not supposed to be wearing white pants after
Labor Day. He yelled at my roommate, okay? That was not directed at me, but very entertained witness during the whole occurrence.
Wasn't it because she rejected him? She like didn't want to
he was like
give him her number?
No, they were just like heckling both of us, and we were just like, we're going home, blah, 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 like, don't talk to us. And then when we were walking away, he yelled at her and he's like, white pants don't go after Labor Day, woman. Anyway, I told that story many times, but yes, never
I know, but I just like, it's so funny. Well, I think you can wear white boots after Labor Day.
Yeah. Anyway.
Ooh, you could do like a black and white cowboy look, like black pants, like a white, black and white top or something like that with the white boots, and do like a black and white cowboy.
I could. We'll think about it. We'll sit on it. Anyway, so that's tonight. I will see what I can pull together, and then I don't know what I'm up to tomorrow, but it's a very chilly weekend here in New York, and I don't know, it's kind of nice because especially back in the summer when like everyone was out doing everything all the time, but even like into the fall and everything, I feel like I always had plans for like every day of the weekend, and I always had something coming up on the books and everything, which was really fun. Mm-hmm. But I recently have just been like going with the flow more and like not making plans on the weekends and just kind of like having more chill time. And I mean, I guess because it's winter and people aren't like out doing as many things, that's kind of natural, but it's just been really nice and relaxing, and I've had a lot of just rejuvenating laid back days and weekend days recently, so it's been good. So
that's good.
Yeah, just chilling. But
in Cedar Rapids.
Yes,
great. 20 minutes of updates. Let's read a book.
Let's read a freaking book. I'm so excited to get into this one, you guys. I just read it actually yesterday morning because it was such a quick read, so it's fresh in my mind, The Four Agreements. And I don't know, when I first looked, like when you read just the headlines of each of the agreements, they seem kind of like generic or common sense almost. But the way that he describes them and breaks them down and puts them into different perspectives is very refreshing. And I just really like the way that he like positions some of these things, where you might read it and it might say like, okay, always be yourself. Or no, what is it? Always do your best. And you're like, okay, like that's pretty generic advice. But the way that he like positions that and how you can look at what doing your best is just such a refreshing like sentiment. So I'm very excited to discuss.
It's so different than like, you know, imagine a teacher in school telling a student always do your best. Like it has such a different connotation than how he talks about it in this book.
Exactly.
You know, and that sometimes saying always do your best, the meaning behind it is in direct contrast with what actually doing your best means. So it's very interesting. I want to tell you guys a little bit about like what this book is. So it's a Toltec wisdom book, and it's grounded in a lot of kind of stories and allegories from this guy's beliefs and like the legends of the Toltec people. Mm-hmm. So it opens up talking about and who the Toltec people were. They were people of knowledge in southern Mexico and from thousands of years ago.
People of knowledge.
Yeah, that's what he calls them, people of knowledge. And so he starts off with a lot of different stories about these people and what they believed, and about specifically this one man who had enlightenment and that sort of founded a lot of these beliefs, I would say, or at least, you know, that's kind of how he talks about it. But before we dive into that, Christy, I'm curious about your knowledge of this book. Had you ever been told of this book, heard about it, recommended to read it by anyone prior to this?
So many times, yeah. I've heard about it for a long time, honestly. I've definitely, like, I've always heard the Four Agreements, and I've seen, like, graphics of them, and I've, like, heard, I definitely heard the, like, and we've talked about it a little bit in the past, too, just when it's been relevant to what we've talked about, because you had read it, I remember. But especially the second point, which I feel is probably the most famous of just gathering, you know, what I've heard from other people discussing it, which is don't take anything personally. And I think that's a really powerful message that he has. And I've heard that in a lot of contexts, like relating to the book and how he talks about it. So, yeah, I've definitely been aware of it, but I've just never actually read it myself. So this is the perfect opportunity to motivate myself to for book club. And also we thought it'd be good for the top of the year because it's like a good way to kind of reset and check in with yourself when you're looking at your goals and evaluating where you are in your life and everything. I think these are also great points that he makes that can help.
And it is such a healthy book. Like no matter where you are at in your life, no matter what your job is, no matter where you're at in your relationships, like no matter any of those things, there's absolutely nothing about this book that will make you feel behind, that will make you feel shamed, like you're not good enough, that will make you feel shamed. It's literally about uplifting you from exactly where you are right now. And that is one of the things I like so much about this book and why I think it's so good for January. Because when you think about other self-help or personal growth books that you could read in January, if they're the kind of thing that like you're already in kind of a delicate place or you're kind of feeling unsure of yourself or where you're going and you were to read a certain book, like if I would have read freaking Meg Jay's book while I was unemployed, I think it would have been really hard for me. I think it would have been kind of triggering at points, you know, but this book, you can really just pick it up wherever you're at in your life. And I think it will be nothing but like have positive influence. At least, you know, it might take reading it a couple times because I read it the first time. How long ago was it? I don't know. A couple years ago.
I don't know either.
And it was a lot for me then. And it was, you know, it really opened my eyes to some things. But now reading it a second time, I was like, well, okay, this is really like reaffirming these things. And I'm seeing new things and I have new perspectives on some of these things. So I honestly think it's a book that's valuable to read more than once. Like keep your copy, keep your notes. And when you start to feel yourself falling off some of these things, you know, you can refresh on it, you know?
Definitely. So we're going to start and break down. I think we should just go like section by section with the four different agreements and talk about like how we interpreted them and some of our favorite passages that stood out to us. And then we also, of course, got you guys involved on the Instagram at Fingers Crossed Pod. We would never leave you out of this conversation because book club is for all of us. So we have input from you all relating to each topic and then kind of like your general thoughts on the book. So before we get into that, we can start with just kind of like the general poll of how you liked it, because we did pose a question that just simply asked overall feeling, did you like it? Did you feel it was impactful or did you find it overrated? So 66% of people said that they loved it and 34% said it was kind of overrated, which I'm kind of surprised that it was that high that people said it was overrated, but I was kind of thinking that, and we'll talk about this later, like because we posted another question that was asking like if you found it overrated, why? But I do think that maybe because there is just a lot of hype around the book and it is kind of famous, that a lot of people have very lofty expectations for it. And it is a good book, but, you know, I think it's all about your expectations going into a book. So if you haven't read it yet,
yeah. Another thing I want to say about it that I think, while this author could never write differently because he's writing based on his own personal truth, he's not writing this to, you know, appeal to a certain audience. That is very clear. He's writing from his personal truth. There's a lot of mention to stuff that I think people would consider kind of woo-woo. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, very spiritual.
It's very spiritual. There's a lot of mentions to God. There's a lot of mentions to ancient wisdom, to awakening, to light beings, like things like that, that I think to people who are much more, or who are used to mainstream literature or like mainstream writing, they might write off the book because maybe they don't believe in God, or maybe they don't understand like the teachings of ancient Toltec wisdom. You know what I mean? Like, they might just think like, this is not relatable to me.
Mm-hmm. And, like, taking it too literally almost.
Exactly. Like, you know, whatever your personal beliefs about spirituality and God are, like, you can replace those things with anything in your life.
You can put it in your own context, you know, that makes sense for you.
Exactly. You can put it in your own context. And I did that. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not taking it literally.
Exactly.
But I think that that definitely is something that could turn people off to it, especially if they are not looking or necessarily as open to other styles of writing or other perspectives. You know what I mean? Yeah. So I think that's the only thing as far as the book's accessibility. But if you're able to either look past it or better embrace it, you know,
yeah,
it opens up your mind.
I didn't even think about that because, I mean, I'm not like an overly spiritual person at all, but I didn't really find that it was like taking me out of the book or anything, because I didn't think it was like too overwhelming. But also, I guess I kind of went into it realizing that it was going to be like kind of that. So I think, again, it's about your expectations and just like going into it with the right frame of mind to be open to the ideas and not just like taking them at face value, but kind of like what you said, putting it in your own context for sure. I think that will definitely help. But yeah, maybe that's part of it. Yeah. We'll see what people say when we get into the answers. But yeah, 66% of people loved it, which is the majority. So I'd say that that's a winner. I don't remember what people said about the Meg J book, if they overall liked it, but I think it was more controversial than this. So
yeah,
we shall see. But anyway.
Yeah, I actually had a discussion with a friend of mine who just read the book.
This one? And book?
Who read the Meg J book, Defining Decade. And we were talking. I asked him, you know, he's like, oh, I know you discussed it on your podcast. So, like, what do you think? And I told him all my thoughts. And he really didn't like it. He didn't like it at all. He thought she was condescending and privileged. And he thought that a lot of the chapters were irrelevant and, like, didn't make sense and, like, all this stuff. And I was like, wow, it's definitely, you know, not for everybody. But it's interesting because one of the chapters that he disliked the most was one of the ones I liked the most, but he brought up points that were like reasons he didn't like it that I hadn't really considered. And I was kind of like, oh, that's interesting, you know? So that's why I love book club. I love
people's thoughts,
hearing people's perspective on things.
Exactly. The first section is agreement number one, which is be impeccable with your word. And he actually started out this section with a definition of impeccable that I've never heard of before that I thought was so interesting and actually gave me a lot of context to put it in my own life. And he defined it as impeccable literally means without sin. Like, im means without, and then peccable comes from, I think, a Latin word that is
to sin. Yeah.
Yeah. And so you read that and you're like, okay, without sin. And then you immediately probably tie it to like a religious context, because that's like the normal association, I would say, or a typical one. And then he goes on immediately after that and defines it as sin doesn't mean, you know, necessarily a religious wrong. It means anything that goes against yourself, or like anything that's contradicting to who you are. If you go against yourself, that's what he's defining sin as. And so when you look at that, I think that is such a good way to look at it, even just in life, like anything that goes against who you are, that's kind of like not in alignment with your values, or, you know, causing friction in your life, like any of those things, that would be what a sin would be. So that when you're impeccable with your word, you're being true to yourself, essentially. So I just really like that off the bat, before I even got into any of the real concepts around it, but just framing of that was really powerful on its own. And I just really liked how he worded it. But
yeah, when I read this book for the first time without having read the chapter, my assumption in my head was, and it's funny because the third agreement is don't make assumptions, but my assumption in my head was, be impeccable with your word means like don't lie to other people, don't tell bad things to other people, don't you know, make things up that aren't true, don't brag, like, you know, all that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, follow through on your commitments, your like that kind of thing.
I had no concept that it was going to mostly be about the words you use towards yourself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the words you use, you know, because we're so not focused on caring about ourselves. It's literally at the, like, the bottom of our priority list in the way that we speak to ourselves. You know, it's something I've talked with my friends about multiple times, you know, would you talk to your friends the way you talk to yourself? Mm-hmm. And I think that's a huge part of what this chapter is talking about. You know, being impeccable with your word is like not using all of that negative self-talk and saying things like, oh, I'm so stupid, or why can't I figure this out? I'm so behind. Because when you say those things, you're not being impeccable with your word, and you're creating agreements that you start to believe. He believes that your word is magic.
And then, like, negative self-talk is black magic, is what he calls
black magic. Yeah. Because the word is the magic that humans possess, and misuse of the word is black magic. We are using black magic all the time without knowing that our word is magic at all. You have so much power over yourself, over others. And he gives lots of examples about how times people misused their word against people and had absolutely no idea the impact it had. Yes. And then he talks about a little girl who was singing, and she was happy, and her mom was having a really bad day, and so she had no tolerance for noise, and so she snapped at the little girl and told her, like, stop singing, your voice sucks, like, stop singing. Because she was in her own belief, in her own world, angry with her own problems, had nothing to do with the singing. And to this little girl, she never sang again, and she believed from that moment on that her voice was awful, that she shouldn't sing, and, you know, she stopped, you know, speaking up in class, like, all these things. It completely affected her life. And something that I really like about this passage, as sad as it is that it says, her mother didn't notice what she did with her word. She didn't notice that she used black magic and put a spell on her daughter. She did not know the power of her word, and therefore she isn't to blame. You know, it would be very easy to blame the mom for saying something so harsh and so terrible. But a lot of times we're stuck in this cycle of not realizing the power of our words. Yeah. And I'm sure that mom, similar things had been said to her, you know, and you don't realize the power of the things you say to others. And think about if what she said to that little girl was so powerful, think about the words you say to yourself every day. Constantly, like, what are the things you're reaffirming to yourself? You know, I see on Instagram people are doing the, you know, where they say those daily affirmations, you know, manifestations, you know, I am smart, I am bold, I am brave, healthy, you know, all
I
those
wealthy,
things.
I am rich, I am that bitch.
Yeah, that, you know, but like that, it always has seemed to me kind of like, I don't know, I don't want to use the word woo woo again, but like a floofy, like it just feels like, oh, I don't need to do that. Like, sit there and be like, I am smart, I am brave, I am kind, I am all these things.
Can I just interject really quick?
Please.
I don't know if this is relevant to what you're about to say, but I have heard that affirmations only work if you actually believe those things in the first place. If you actually, like, have confidence and think you're hot, but you're just having an off day, and then you tell yourself, I'm beautiful, you'll actually, like, it'll lift you up. But if you don't really believe that at your core, it's just going to feel like floof and go over your head, because it's not an affirmation. Mm-hmm. It's just, it feels like a lie. It feels like you're lying to yourself. So affirmations can work if you actually have that underlying foundation of believing those things deep down, but a lot of people don't. And that's why it seems kind of hollow when you're saying these things like, I am this and strong and this, when you don't actually feel it. So that might be mm-hmm. why it feels that way, is what I'm saying. But go on.
No, absolutely. I completely agree. But I just love how important he tells, you know, he says that your word is, you know, that don't treat it so lightly, that if you say things to yourself like, oh, well, I look ugly in this dress, but whatever, going on with my day, like, that's not a casual statement. You know, you say it to yourself so casually, like it's a joke. But it's not, you know, and it really is so powerful.
Yeah. And I think also not more importantly, but a huge part of it is just like the aspect of how your words impact other people. And it's like you'll make these beliefs based on what other people tell you. Like, for example, in this book, kind of similar to the singing thing, he also mentions, like, if someone gives an opinion and says, look, this girl is ugly, the girl listens, believes she's ugly, grows up with the idea that she's ugly, and it doesn't matter how beautiful she is, as long as she has that agreement that was based on someone's opinion that was, like, fleeting years ago, like, she'll believe that she's ugly, and that's the spell that she's under. That's what he says. By hooking our attention, the word can enter our mind and change a whole belief for better or for worse. So on the flip side of that, maybe years later, she won't change that agreement that deep down she believes she's ugly until someone else, maybe one day, that has more influence in her life, looks at her and says, like, you're not ugly, like, you're beautiful, and then you actually start to believe it, kind of thing, which feels which is hard because I'm kind of torn between the, like, you don't need, you know, that's like relying on external validation and you should be able to give that to yourself. But at the same time, like, sometimes having that, you know, you can say it to yourself in the mirror so many times, but you won't believe it until you have like some sort of concrete evidence, and having other people validate that does help. So I don't know, like, I don't know what the right answer is there, but I think it's just, it really just shows that, like, when you say negative things that are, you might feel like you're just expressing like a opinion that doesn't actually matter, like, it could totally have an effect on someone that comes for years. And I'm sure that anyone listening to this, I included, could think of times in my life where someone's made a comment to me that I've never forgotten that was negative. Like, yeah. I still think about when a boy in the seventh grade called me a gap-toothed bitch. Like, that has never left
Did
my
he
brain.
Really?
Yes. And then I bought rubber bands and closed the fucking gap in my teeth because it affected me that much. And he probably forgot it the next week. You know what I'm saying? Like, little fleeting comments that shouldn't, and like, I didn't really care that much about what this boy thought, but it just impacted me so much. And everyone has those, mm-hmm. you know? And I think being impeccable with your word and really being mindful about how you talk to other people and how they could change their own view of themselves based on what you say, even if you don't think that they're going to value your opinion. Maybe they don't, but that'll still stick with them. So I just think that that's so crazy to think about, and like the examples that he gives and how, you know, it can take, it's just much easier to bring someone down than it is to rebuild that confidence once it's already been knocked down by one person even. So I think,
oh, completely.
It's also good to go out of your way and like compliment people and lift them up, like genuinely, and things that you really mean, and things when you see someone doing something great, like acknowledge it and like give them that validation, because you never know how they might need it, you know, mm-hmm. beyond the surface too.
No, it's so true. Like, I was just thinking about, and I've talked about this in a previous episode. I don't remember what it was about, but like when someone said something to me similar, they're like, yeah, wow, Sierra, do you always talk so much? You know, and it literally from that moment on, I've never forgotten. And I'll be like at a party mm-hmm. chatting and being excited and talking about whatever it is that I love to talk about. And all of a sudden that comment will pop into my head and I will literally be silent. Yeah. And I'll be like, mm-hmm. I've been talking, and I get super self-conscious, and it's like, it's literally one dumbass person's opinion, but yet it roots in, if you let it grow, it will grow.
Yeah. And I feel like that just underscores like a lot that resonated with me, that made me think when I was reading this, is he goes on to talk about kind of like, yeah, it's one thing when one person says something, but especially, I don't even think he was talking about the internet per se, because I think this was written in the 90s, but like when you hear a ton of people's opinions, and when you're always you're bombarded with these unsolicited thoughts from people, or their, you know, takes on your life and everything, like you start to believe them, and it's just so taxing on you. And it's really made me think about just like the power of the internet and getting all of these like opinions from people that you don't know, that you're never going to see their faces, that really don't matter to you, but they wear you down, especially yeah. And like, it's just crazy like how much power words have, and even beyond a screen and everything. And it just really adds up, which is why like I haven't for a long time, like I've been very conscious about how often I let myself read comments about myself. And I just think that even for better or for worse, like yeah. he even said here, like good words can also, you know, it can go the other way where it'll like overinflate the ego or something. Like, actually, maybe he doesn't say like yeah. that, but.
Well, he talks about that more in the second chapter of not taking things personally.
Yes. Oh, that's right. That's the context for that.
Because, and we'll get into that, but he's saying, you know, just like you shouldn't take things at face value when people say bad things about you, you shouldn't
really
also take everything
that.
At face value mm-hmm. when they say a bunch of good things about you. You know, all of your sense of self should come from you
yeah.
and not from anything people say about
yeah,
you.
Yeah, so maybe I'm thinking of that chapter when he talks about don't take things personally, but he did talk about something about like hearing a lot of opinions at once. But I just think that really underscores like how unhealthy it is now in the culture that we have, that it's just so common, you know, young teenagers getting thousands of comments on TikTok that are like tearing them down, or like things that they'll start to internalize. And like some people might have a thicker skin than others, but it'll still affect them sometimes. And it's just not healthy. Like, you should not be able to hear the thoughts and opinions of millions and thousands and even like 10 random people you don't know. Like, you're not equipped yeah. to handle that, really. So it's just good to be conscious about how you're like monitoring that for yourself, I would say, in this economy, in today's world.
No, of course. I want to share a couple of our responses we asked you guys. What does being impeccable with your word mean to you? And this one I really like. She said, your initial thoughts don't have to match the truth. Think before you speak. Mm-hmm. And that is something that I have run into problems with in the past, is like being so hot-headed or like so fired up by emotion in a moment that I just want to say the first thing that comes to my mind. But your initial thoughts don't always match the truth, because a lot of times your initial thoughts are really full, charged with emotion and personal reaction, like your reaction to something based on your experience. Yeah,
your own filter.
Exactly. Your own glass, or like your lenses, you know, however you see the world. And that if you always impulsively speak and act based on that, you could absolutely do damage with your word that you don't mean, or that isn't even having to do with that other person. That's all coming from your personal trauma, your personal reaction. Mm-hmm. And I think if we all in the world worked on that, we would be a lot happier place. It's something he also talks about in this book a lot, is he uses the words heaven and hell, and not in a sense of like a religious, oh, thou shalt go to these places, but that how we live on earth is hell. And it's hell because we are not following the agreements that will make us happy. Like, you know, we are prisoners by always caring what people think. We're prisoners by not impeccably using our word, by not doing our best or pushing ourselves to do more than our best, and by always making assumptions and all of these things that lead us to this state of a general unhappiness. And that he truly believes that if you follow these agreements, you will get out of that hell. And I think, you know, again, easier said than done, because you are so ingrained in these beliefs. I'm ingrained in these things. Christy, like, we all are so ingrained. It's not like you can just one day turn it off and be like, oh, I'm going to stop caring what people think today. I'm going to stop making a single assumption today. I'm going to stop, you know, all these things I've learned. It literally takes
practice,
an insane amount of practice. Yeah,
definitely. So you can't like shame yourself for it not coming naturally to you, because it doesn't come naturally. It's like not, it's in human nature. Like he talks about a lot of like broader, besides like the interpersonal like talk that could be negative, but broader, like how gossip and that poison of negative words infiltrating like multiple people, and you just hear it, something from someone, and immediately have that thought about the other person and like don't even like question it, that kind of thing. And there's just so many things that we're programmed to kind of like just, or maybe even socially conditioned to just accept, or like, you know, don't challenge those things or don't stand up for those people or whatever, because it's just like, oh, people are talking, whatever. And then you just internalize that negative thing about someone you don't even know and believe the gossip, and it really is like poisonous. And I really liked how he talked about that, because I feel like a lot of people don't really so much. Like people kind of, I don't know, when you're a kid, there's always like, don't gossip, you know, be a good friend, blah, blah, blah. But I feel like as an adult, that's not really talked about very much. Like gossip is still very much, it doesn't end when you leave high school and everything. Like it's still a very common thing for people to do. It's like a bonding thing, you know, misery loves company, and they want to talk about other people and feel better about themselves. And I don't know. I think that was also a really valuable part of this chapter, is being impeccable with your word and don't just perpetuate, you know, negative gossip about someone else, because you're only spreading that kind of poison if you're not even like questioning it, especially, or right, you don't even know if it's true. Like, I hate gossip.
Another one I want to share from our listeners about what being impeccable with your word means is, she said, speaking with intention, know what you're going to say and why you are saying it. Because a lot of times people think that like, oh, well, being impeccable with your word means you can only ever say nice things to people, and you can only ever, you know, if you don't have any, you know, I do believe in it in general, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all. But sometimes you need to say, give people feedback or give constructive criticism or let someone know they hurt you or let someone know that their actions hurt you. But being intentional about how you say it and why you are saying it. Why are you saying, like, why are you telling someone something negative, or why are you sharing this feedback, you know, like, and having it, make sure that what you say is intentional and thinking about it, because there are multiple ways to say the same thing, and one could really affect someone really hurtfully, negatively for the rest of their life, and one could be a really engaging and powerful teaching moment. You know what I mean? It's just it all comes down to how something is framed.
Yeah, definitely. And also, a lot of people said kind of just like, be honest and true, think about the impact your words could have on yourself or others, which are very strong things about this chapter as well. And then speak your truth, be thoughtful and loving with your word, and know how it holds much power, which is great. But yeah, I think again, like those things seem kind of simple at face value, but when you really read the whole chapter and delve into how he frames it and like puts it into different contexts, it's just really, really valuable, I would say. But yeah, And also back to the gossip thing really quick, I just remembered a passage that I highlighted. He described it as like a computer virus. So one little piece of misinformation can like get thrown into your computer system and it literally spreads like a virus because it spreads between people. And then it's just kind of like lives in your system of that like or the breakdown of communication between people too, which also could be like tied to broader problems of misinformation in society that cause like actual, you know, political issues or, you know, physical violence, like those things. Like it could be a huge chain reaction of just like people spreading things and not being intentional or like not questioning when they're just passing on an email chain or things like that, where it's like you don't know, you're not being mindful of this and how you're spreading something, whether it's like petty gossip or dangerous misinformation on the internet. Like it literally is a virus and it can have very detrimental effects in society.
Yeah, it's funny. He actually wrote a follow-up book called The Fifth Agreement. Ooh. And I don't remember it verbatim, but part of it is to always be skeptical. Mm. Oh, it's always be skeptical, but willing to listen. And I think that so relates to that because we are sponges. We naturally just want to believe people, when, especially someone with a commanding, charismatic presence who tells you information. You just want to believe it because it's easy and it's fun and you feel like you're part of something. You know, it is so easy to just believe people at face value. And I have gotten into trouble for that many times, of just believing exactly what somebody says without taking the time to be skeptical, to research it myself, to put my own opinions towards something. And one of the examples they use about that is like, if you're going into a class and someone leaving the class is like, oh, you're going to hate this teacher. Mm-hmm. They're a jerk. They grade really unfairly and they're a pervert. You're immediately going to go into this class like potentially already disliking this teacher, when that person's statements could have been because the teacher gave them a bad grade, they were having a bad day, they didn't like something the teacher said, like, you know, and then you're already going into it with these preconceived notions that are likely going to make you hate the class, maybe drop out, you know, instead of just being like, all right, that was an opinion, I'm going to make my own opinions for myself.
Yeah, definitely. And it's definitely easier said than done. And again, something that takes practice, but very important to keep in mind. Okay, shall we move on to the second agreement?
Second agreement.
Which is my favorite one, personally, which is don't take things personally. Because I think this is at the core of so many people's problems and so many, you know, anxiety kind of issue, not like clinical anxiety, but, you know, feelings of anxiety or worrying or, you know, people who just make, I mean, it kind of goes hand in hand with making assumptions and taking things personally, kind of like they are related, but it is different. But I just really liked how he really framed it. Bottom line, like, do not like things that people say don't reflect on you, even if they're directed at you. Like it's always a reflection of them. And it's always, you know, their lens that they're putting it through and their own hurt that they're projecting on you, or et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly.
Like, there's very few, unless you've truly done something wrong and you've murdered someone's uncle and then they're coming at you. Like, maybe it is about you. But most of the time, little comments are about them and, like, issues that they have that they're distorting through their words to try and project onto you to make themselves feel better, essentially.
Absolutely. And I truly think when I look back on my life, on all of the times that someone has said something mean to me or unkind or used their word non-impeccably, shall we say, it was because they were hurting.
Yeah.
And from whatever it was in their life, people, when they are hurting, they hurt others.
Totally.
And so if you look at anyone who has wronged you, I remember listening to a podcast about this one day when I was getting ready for a Disney shift. It was about like happiness or something like that. But he was saying, anytime someone wrongs you, look at them with compassion and know that they're hurting and they have wronged you because they're hurting. And you are independent of that, you know, almost all of the time. But it's something that taking things personally is something that is, it's really hard for me to not do. And I think it's hard for so many people out there because nobody wants to be mistreated. Nobody wants to be hurt, especially when you've, you know, really gone out of your way to do good on someone and then they mistreat you. You know, it feels really bad. And you wonder why you're not good enough and why you didn't try hard enough.
You didn't deserve that treatment. Yeah.
Exactly. And then, you know, oftentimes it can really start driving you crazy, especially if you're out there seeking approval from others, mm-hmm. and you're not getting it. And so then you keep changing yourself and trying new things. Like, what if I try this, will they finally give me that approval? Well, if I try this, will they, if I say this, if I wear this, if I do this, will they finally give me that approval I'm looking for, when it was never there to give in the first place, because they're too wrapped up in their own hurt and their own lens and their own story to give you what you need. Mm-hmm. It's like, and so you've got two people who are hurting in separate circles that are just spinning and spiraling, never intersecting. And it just creates this further down spin of misery.
Yeah. It's like self-enforcing. Exactly. And then it's like, you're hurt by someone else's words because they're hurt, and then you project that on someone else, and yeah, it's like the opposite of pay it forward. It's like,
exactly,
don't infect everyone with your computer virus of misery. Yeah, so exactly how he says, this is a quote that just the way that he words it is, nothing other people do is because of you, it's because of themselves, and all people live in their own dream, their own mind, and they're completely in a different world from the one we live in. When we take something personally, we make the assumption that they know what's in our world, and we try to impose our world on their world. So again, I think it's such a good way to look at it. Like, and also, interestingly, he puts it that personal importance, or taking things personally, is the maximum expression of selfishness, because we make the assumption that everything is about me, which seems like kind of, you know, accusatory, but it's true. Like, you're really thinking that everything's about you, even if it is a comment directed at you, it really is not a reflection of you.
You know, I can give the perfect example of this. I was at a drive-thru, and the person who is such a small example, but the person who was taking my order at the little box at the drive-thru was not very nice. They were snappy. They were short. I had to do modifications on my food. So I'm like, oh, I need no cheese on this and extra lettuce on this. And they were being really snappy, and it really hurt my feelings. This drive-thru person could have literally just had a horrible day, been broken up with, yelled at by their boss.
You never know.
Like, literally anything. I took it personally, and you know what happened? I snapped at the cashier at the second window, because I was upset. I felt like I'd had my feelings hurt, and then I was in a bad mood, and so I snapped at that person. You know what probably happened then? That person snapped at their coworker, and it just set off a chain of angry people being angry and hurt.
Yeah, it rubs off on you, for sure.
Instead, if I would have been like, okay, you know, that person's probably going through it. Let me have some compassion for them. They're hurting. And look at it that way, instead of then spinning that negativity onto the next person. Right. You know, it's like, it just happens so quickly on such a small scale. One of the things that I like that he calls it is emotional garbage, like that, those like negative words and that taking things personally. And he says, taking things personally makes you pray for those predators, those black magicians, again, using the word in not impeccably, is black magic. They can hook you easily with one little opinion and feed you whatever poison they want. And because you take it personally, you eat it up. You eat all of that emotional garbage, and now it becomes your garbage. Mm-hmm. Because that is what it feels like. It feels like garbage on the inside. You just, because it feels horrible.
Yeah.
But then he says, if you do not take things personally, you are immune in the middle of hell. Mm. And he is calling that cycle of taking things personally, you know, is that hell on earth, as he talks about.
Yeah, that's good. One of my favorite passages that I think is just such a good way to look at it is, I mean, yeah, here, I'll just read the quote. He says, you may even tell me, Miguel, what you are saying is hurting me, but it is not what I am saying that is hurting you. It is that you have wounds that I touch by what I've said. You're hurting yourself, which makes it seem like kind of victim blamey, but it's really, it's more just about framing that, like, you know, words, yeah, it's like you have wounds that might be, you know, triggered by certain things that they don't know when they're saying it, or you're interpreting it as something that's like meant to hurt you, when really, like, you just have that kind of vulnerability that they might not even know of, you know? I don't know. I just mm-hmm. thought that that was an interesting way to look at it. It's like, the word isn't hurting. It's your interpretation of it, because it went through your own personal wounds or your own, you know, traumas or background.
Here's an example. Yes. If someone were to say to me, like, you know, say I'm in a grocery store checkout line, and all of a sudden I'm talking about my day, and then the grocery store person goes like, something, you know, wow, you're so talkative or you're so chatty. Like, they're not even maybe they don't mean it as an insult. Maybe they're just being like, oh, you're a chatty girl. Like, you're a talkative person. But because I have been insulted about it before and I have been hurt by it before, I will immediately take that personally and be, because it's a trigger for me. If someone tells me, oh, you're talking a lot, or Sierra talks a lot, or Sierra is, you know,
loud or
you know, whatever, like, I will immediately
clam up,
internalize that, and it, because it's a trigger and it's a sore spot, it's an old wound, and so it's like someone's sticking a knife into an old wound, then they don't even know that they're doing it. They maybe don't even mean it as an insult. Maybe they're just literally like, oh, you're a chatty person, like, yeah, I like talking to you. But immediately it can, and I've seen this happen with a lot of people I know, where accidentally you say a certain buzzword that's a trigger word for them, or reminds them that they're single, reminds them that they're lonely, reminds them that they don't have a job they like, reminds them all of these things, reminds them that their financial situation is not what they want. They take it personally and spit it back on you.
Yeah. And it's the wound that they have that's getting, you know, touched by that.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay, so let's read some of your responses to this chapter on the Instagram. This question was posed as, how has the idea of not taking things personally changed your perspective? And someone says, dwelling less on what happened in the past and allowing me to live in the present. Interesting.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense.
It helps you resolve, like, how maybe something hurt you in the past, but putting it in the context of it wasn't personal does make it easier to kind of, like, be at peace with it, maybe.
Exactly. Like, when you think back to the times you've been hurt the most in your life, or when people have said the most hurtful things to you, you can literally almost always find where that person was hurting, or why they were not doing well, or why they lashed out at you. And it, like, never has to do with you, you know?
It's kind of like on a TV show when you see the school bully, you see their backstory and see that they're having a hard time at home and everything, and you sympathize with them. But then, you know, the protagonist gets hurt by them, but they don't know that the bully is going through their own shit, and that's why they're projecting it and everything. Like, you have, in the moment, as the person who's being picked on or whatever, you don't have the context of the full story that the people watching the movie do. You know what I mean? But you don't have that hindsight. And maybe later on, you'll get it. You'll have a conversation with the bully 10 years later and find out that they were going through this thing that you had no idea about. But a lot of the times you don't. And you have to just, like, let it go and make peace that it wasn't personal, even if you don't know why they said it in the first place.
And it doesn't excuse people's words. It doesn't excuse someone lashing out at you or being unkind to you. It never makes it okay. But it does give you compassion for that person, and it gives you protection. When you realize that people's lashes and their anger and all that stuff and that comes out is coming from somewhere else. Some of these other responses say that not taking things personally helped me to get out of my own bubble, because we only know what we can see and feel. That's another thing, is you make so many, it ties into the assumptions chapter, because you assume what someone is dealing with or feeling or experiencing, because you can only picture your world or know your world from your own lens.
Yeah, exactly. Like this one says, we're so consumed first with ourselves, so it makes sense, but others treat us from their own view. Exactly.
Also, a lot of it comes from how they feel about themselves. Like, it's very hard for people to treat their fellow humans extremely well and with respect when they're not treating themselves well and with respect, because it's all tied into what you see as a normal course of action. This one says, dwelling less, oh, you already read that. This one right here says, I think more about what the other person is going through than what I did.
This one says, I stopped taking responsibility for the behavior of others and blaming for my reactions. That's so good. Like, taking responsibility for the way that others act, because you think it's a reflection of you and it's not. Totally.
And that goes the other way, too. If you're, you know, thinking about yourself, that, you know, you can't blame other people for what's happening inside of you. Like, what's happening in, like, if I have a big reaction at a grocery store clerk who called me chatty, like, that's on me because of my experience and my triggers and my past. That is on me to deal with, not them.
Right.
You know, and my reaction towards them would be on me. Yeah.
The third one is, don't make assumptions. So here's a passage that just on the one that I posted on the story. This says, find the courage to ask questions and express what you really want. Communicate with others as clearly as you can to avoid misunderstandings, sadness, and drama. With just this one agreement, you can completely transform your life, which I also feel like is a very powerful one. Next to you, don't take things personally. Don't make assumptions. It's so important.
Absolutely. I'm going to read a quote and then a personal anecdote because it perfectly explains this chapter. This quote says, "All of the sadness and drama you have lived in your life was rooted in making assumptions and taking things personally." Mm-hmm. I don't know if I've ever told this story on the podcast, so if I have, you can stop me. Okay. But it was the first night that when I was first pursuing Jason, mm-hmm. my friend and I were going to surprise him at his work. We had hatched this elaborate plan to go surprise him at work. And my friend was gassing me up that it was going to surprise him. He would be so romantic. He would ask me to hang out after work. He was going to take me on his motorcycle off to Malibu and we were going to share a bottle of wine on the beach. And it was going to be the most romantic night of my life. I got my makeup done. I did my hair. We were like going to surprise him and show up at the bar because he was working as a bartender. And we were so convinced that it was going to be the best night of my mm-hmm. life. Like, we had literally to the point where like, well, he only has one helmet on his motorcycle. What if he wants to take me to the beach and he only has one helmet? What are we going to do? Should we go home and get his other helmet? Like literally, like before he even knew we were coming. Mm-hmm. And I was convinced that all this stuff was going to happen. I was also assuming that he was going to be so excited to see mm-hmm. me, right? Because we had just started talking, we were flirting, whatever. So we get there, we sit at the bar, and he is not excited to see us. I later learn it's not because of me, not because of my friend, but he hates when people visit him at work. Mm. He doesn't like that because he's focused on his work. He's trying to like get his stuff done. Like, he goes into the zone. He doesn't want to have to like stop and chat with his friends while he's trying to like serve people at a bar. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Which is understandable, but I never even considered his perspective. I was only thinking, making my own assumptions.
And writing your love story.
Right. So the night was not going as I expected. He wasn't being very chatty, wasn't being very flirty. Naturally, I assumed it's because he doesn't like mm-hmm. me. I assumed it's because he's not interested in me. And as the night goes on, my dreams of going to Malibu on the motorbike are slowly drifting away. But I decide to throw out one last bone and I go, "Hey, so what are you doing after work?" You know, if a girl who's come to your work to flirt with you asks, "What are you doing after work?" It's very much like a, "I'd like to hang out with you," mm-hmm. you know, like I'm throwing a thing. Anyway, so he goes, "Yeah, I'm busy. I have to wash my dog." And I literally,
I never heard that.
I was so insulted I was like, that is literally like a girl saying I have to wash my hair. Like, he does not want to see me. He hates me. This is not going anywhere. Blah, blah, blah. Now look, here we are engaged. But anyway, I drove home with my friend. I cried in the car the entire way home, assumed that he hated me, that we were never meant to be. It was all a mistake, blah, blah, blah. And I cried myself to sleep that night because I felt so dejected. And everything about that entire interaction was, like, again, this passage, I'll read it one more time. "All of the sadness and drama you have lived in your life was rooted in making assumptions and taking things personally. And that night was sad and dramatic as hell because I had made a ton of assumptions and took a ton of things personally." When later, the next day, he texted me being like, "Hey, it was great to see you last night. Sorry, I'm usually pretty distracted at work. What are you up to today? Do you want to hang out?"
Yeah, and then you're immediately like, "Oh, I'm okay."
I'm like, all was well. And I'm just like, these are the kinds of things that we do to ourselves because you create things in your head and assumptions that aren't real.
Yeah.
That you want to be real or don't want to be real.
And especially with that is like the expectations part of it too, which I think goes hand in hand with assumptions, because when you have expectations for something, you're making assumptions about what's going to happen. So it's kind of the same thing. And that's what I always say. It's like, you know, having expectations is what's going to let you down. It's not like an event is ever going to let you down because it is what it is. It's like the you know, story you put around it that it doesn't live up to, or what you expect is going to happen then it doesn't. That's what sets you up for disappointment. It's not like the actual thing that happens, you know.
Isn't there a quote that says expectation is the root of all heartache?
Probably. That would make sense. Something I like would that. Get behind that because it's so true. But yeah, and there you go. Your story didn't end with a moonlit motorcycle ride to Malibu, but at least Jason had a clean dog when you hung out the next day. So
all's well. Yeah, and we got engaged 3 years later, so it all worked out.
There you go. Anyway, one of the things that I highlighted from this is... Oh, I like this one. "We make the assumption that everyone sees life the same way we do. We assume that others think the way we think, feel the way we feel, judge the way we judge, and abuse the way we abuse. That is the biggest assumption that humans make, and this is why we have a fear of being ourselves around others, because we think everyone will judge us, victimize us, abuse us, and blame us as we do ourselves. So even before others have a chance to reject us, we've already rejected ourselves, and that is the way the human mind works. Oh, so good.
I highlighted that too. It's so powerful. And just assuming, again, that everyone sees life the way you do and then not understanding
or everyone
why someone's not seeing eye to eye with
you. Same feelings about, like, people visiting them at work and et cetera, et cetera. People are going to react the same way. That's what I always say. Like, you can't expect people to react the way you do and then that means the same thing.
Because I used to love when people visited me at work. I would get so excited and I would make time to chat with them. So I naturally assumed that everybody would feel the same way.
Or at least this guy that you were into would. Yeah.
Yeah, and they don't. And that's the thing. It's like you can get into so much trouble that way because it's selfish and it's very self-centered to think that everyone is going to feel the same way you do.
Right. If you take action just for the sake of doing it without expecting a reward or being tied to like a certain outcome or expectation, you will find that you enjoy every action you do. Rewards will come, but you are not attached to the reward. You can even get more than you would have imagined for yourself without expecting a reward. So I really like that.
I like that.
Because again, it's all about not being attached to the outcome. It kind of reminds me what he talks about. It's like the concept of practicing detachment. And it's essentially kind of like, actually, this would be interesting to do a more in-depth episode about, but kind of just like not being attached to X, Y, and Z happening. Like doing something because you love it and not being attached to the outcome that you think you're going to get from it. Or being attached to this exact perfect idea of your life and how it's going to pan out that you expect. And just practicing detachment of just, and it is about kind of like being in the moment more and like enjoying the present, you know, focusing on what's in front of you that you can control now and not having this attachment to the outcome, because that's what's going to set you up for disappointment and really just make things miserable for you if it doesn't match your perfect expectations. So I like how he worded that. Wait, sorry, I just read that wrong. That was actually in the fourth agreement chapter. For some reason, which I don't remember the context around how that was related to always do your best, but I think it relates to the assumptions too. They're interconnected. Yeah.
Yeah, they are. Before we move on to the next chapter, I want to read your guys's perspectives on, we asked, how has the idea of don't make assumptions helped you challenge your own assumptions? You guys said, no longer allowing my mind to immediately go to the worst case scenario.
So I think easy to do.
That's so true, because we naturally just want to do that. I think it goes back to like survival mechanisms, as we talked about, you know, in our therapy sessions, you know, you go to worst case scenario because it helped prepare you for an attack of a herd of bison when you were in a survival mode, but you no longer need to do that, but yet we still do. Mm-hmm.
This one says, as an anxious person, I make the worst case assumptions, and it's a reminder to communicate. So yeah, again, like when you just have things unsaid that you just think that the other person can read your mind, or you're assuming that they're going to do something the way that you want them to, it's, you just got to communicate essentially to avoid that assumption gap. And then it ruins relationships.
When people, like, I've had people text me, you know, and I deal with friendship anxiety too all the time, but I've had people text me being like, I just feel like you're mad at me and you hate me. Like, like, are we okay? And I'm like, where in the world did that come from? And they're like, oh, well, you know, in your last text, you used a period and not an exclamation mark.
Exactly.
I'm like, what? Like, I love you. And I think you're awesome. You're like such a good friend. Like, I feel compassion for whatever you're going through, because I don't think I did anything warranted of that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And it's like hard because it also comes from insecurity when people think that, you know, a period means that you're angry at all this, which is a natural assumption to like make. But it's hard. It can be exhausting if someone requires like so much reassurance that like, no, I don't mean that. Mm-hmm. No, I'm not mad. Like constantly, that's when it could be a problem. And that's when, you know, they really need to work on something internally to not be making those assumptions or like not be taking it personally and all those things. Like, it kind of goes back to that and like working on themselves in that too.
I love this one. It says, this aligns with the therapy skill in DBT, which is dialectic behavioral therapy, of check the facts. So I use it often. I'll have to look up what that is, but I think I can assume that check the facts means to like actually analyze the situation and be like, okay, what are the facts?
Yeah.
What is actually a truth in this situation? And what is something I've made up in my head?
We did that with my therapist. She would always bring that up, the like cycle of, oh, I wish I remembered the exact thing, but it's kind of like belief, or no, maybe it goes assumption, belief, and then emotion that comes from that. Like, you're making an assumption that, you know, this is going to happen because of something you said, but then it creates this belief that you will feel like this because of that. It's hard to say in the abstract, I guess. And then it creates mm-hmm. this emotion is going to come from it based on that assumption that you make that turns into a belief kind of thing. Like, it is a vicious mm-hmm. cycle, which is something like to deconstruct those things is a tool of therapy, and particularly DBT, I guess, is challenging those assumptions and like really seeing, okay, do you have evidence to back this up? Or like, what proof do you have that that's going to happen, or that that's what they meant? Like, what other context do you have about it? And a lot of times mm-hmm. you can find that, oh, there actually isn't evidence that this is true. Like, it's just something that I have in my head. Okay, shall we move on to the last agreement? The last agreement is always do your best. Which reminds me of this song that maybe I should refrain. My Catholic school, from middle school, I went to this Catholic school. And our principal wrote this song that he made us sing at like morning prayer all the time. And it's called Good, Better, Best. So let me just sing it for you really quick. Good, okay. Better, Best. Never let it rest. Till the good is better. And the better, best, good, do the right thing, to be honest and to try. Okay, that's it. I'm not gonna go.
No, please. I want to hear believing, the whole thing.
Don't be discouraged. Keep on growing. Best believe. This is where it gets religious. Believe the promise and the life God made for you. Remember Christ's example and the love that is so true. And then it goes again. Good, better, best. And he would jam out with his guitar. It's like Catholic kids.
This was in school.
Yeah, Catholic school. This is what we did.
Did your teacher have your teacher played the guitar?
Oh, no, the principal did. He was a very musical guy. He also left the principalship to tour with his band after that.
Nice. Good for him. Way to get out of the small town. Wow. Well, thank you for that. That was a treat I didn't expect to have. I am so excited to share that in this episode with everyone.
Yeah, that's what every time I read something about doing your best in this episode, I could not get that out of my
head. You would
sing
that song.
Yeah, exactly. But always do your best. And I really like this passage because it really delves into a lot more context, because it's like seems like such a surface level thing. Like, okay, yeah, try things. Like, do better. Apply yourself. Yada, yada, yada. Like, you think you know what he's going to say, but he actually puts in a lot of different contexts that make it more in depth than you would think, is what I would say.
I agree. And I think the big thing is when you think of always do your best, a lot of it is ingrained in like this, the what they teach in school, what is projected in capitalism, that like your best has to be a certain standard, and that like you never reach your best. Mm-hmm. You know, that you always have to do better and better and better, and like that your best is not good enough sometimes. And if it's not at this certain standard, and I feel like when people say a lot of times in the modern world, like, oh, you got to do your best on this, or I've always got to push my best. Like, it comes with a lot of this kind of like productivity centered illusion that's really kind of toxic, yeah. You know, and not necessarily grounded in actually what is your best. And I'll read this in a minute, but one of my favorite things is he says your best changes at any given moment. Mm-hmm. Like, your best when you're sick is not going to be the same as when you're well. Your best when you're happy is going to be better than your best when you're sad. Like, your best when you are, you know, sober will be different than when you're drunk. Like, all these different things that he gives examples of, that like you can't hold yourself to a single standard all the time, because we are constantly changing and in different circumstances. Right. So I'm going to read the first part of this chapter. He says, there's just one more agreement, but it's the one that allows the other three to become deeply ingrained habits. The fourth agreement is about the action of the first three. Always do your best. Under any circumstance, always do your best, no more and no less. But keep in mind that your best is never going to be the same from one moment to the next. Everything is alive and changing all the time. So your best will sometimes be high quality, and other times it will not be as good.
Mm-hmm.
And then he goes on to list all these different examples of situations. But I think as he goes on into this this chapter, it just very much, it's very forgiving. It feels very like letting yourself be a human being and do the best you can in that moment. Mm-hmm. And if you push yourself to do the best you can in that moment without overachieving or without underachieving, then you can't judge yourself, because you've just done the best you can.
Right.
I'll just read one more passage that I really liked, then I'll pass it over to Christy. He says, If you always do your best, there is no way you can judge yourself. And if you don't judge yourself, there is no way you are going to suffer from guilt, blame, and self-punishment. By always doing your best, you will break a big spell that you've been under.
Yes, that's so good. I also really like how he frames it in terms of, like, living in the present moment, kind of how we talked about. But mm-hmm. he says, like, you have to surrender and let go of the past, and you allow yourself to be fully alive in the moment. Letting go of the past means you can enjoy the dream that's happening right now. And if you live in a past dream, you don't enjoy what's happening right now because you always wish it to be different than it is. And there's no time to miss anyone or anything because you are alive. Not enjoying what's happening right now is living in the past and being only half alive. And that leads to self-pity, suffering, and tears. So it's kind of like, yeah, doing your best means like being in the present moment and applying everything you can to this moment. And also something that I really, really liked that he said, which I don't actually think was in this passage. I think it might have been in the next one. But it relates to that in that... Oh, see, I already read the thing I highlighted because it was for the last one. Yeah, I think also like in that same token, he kind of talks about like living for and... unpromised future kind of thing. Like for most people, they go to work every day just thinking of payday. They'll go, you know, they need to have see where their money will come from or for the work they're doing, and they can hardly wait for Friday. They're always living for like the weekend. They're living for this like vacation in the future. They're living for this like XYZ instead of just living and enjoying what they're doing in the moment and like the tangible things that they can. And they resist what they're doing because of it, because they're working for the reward. And they try to avoid the action and it becomes more difficult and they don't do their best. So I think that's also part of it. It's like doing your best is being as much of who you are and how you can enjoy things and put your most effort into it in the moment and not just like living for mm-hmm. this either in the present or the past, which is, again, like something I didn't expect him to talk about in this about like doing your best. But I think it's such a good way to look at it.
And you can think about it in terms of work. Like if you're working on a project, are you doing a good job because you want an accolade from your boss, because you want your boss to, you know, put you on the employee of the month board and be like, wow, so-and-so did so good at this. Like, are you doing it for that? Because if you don't get that, but yet you still did really good work, you're going to feel like your work sucked. But if you're doing your best on a project that you know is your best and you're proud of the work you do, then you will be proud of it independent of like the feedback that you get. Mm-hmm, you know what exactly. I mean?
And this also says if you take action because you have to, then there's no way you're going to do your best. Then it's better to not do it. No, you do your best because you're doing... Oh, wait. No, you do your best because doing your best all the time makes you so happy. When you're doing your best just for the pleasure of doing it, you're taking action because you enjoy the action. And action is about living fully. Inaction is the way we deny life. Inaction is sitting in front of the television every day for years because you're afraid to be alive and take the risk of expressing what you are. Expressing what you are is taking action. See, there's just so much. Like, I could read this whole thing, but I'll stop myself.
I know.
But...
there are so many passages that, like, I want to read that are so important. I just really recommend you guys read this book. And you don't have to take everything in it at face value. Mm-hmm. You don't have to read it literally. Like, just take little bits and pieces. Because there, especially if you're someone that struggles with negative self-talk and putting pressure on yourself and judgment, there's just so much in this book that is wanting to set you free of that.
Mm-hmm. And he also puts this in the context of the other chapters, too, which I really like. So this is kind of, like, a good way to tie it up. Is don't expect that you'll always be able to be impeccable with your word. Your routine habits are too strong and firmly rooted in your mind, but you can do your best. Don't expect that you'll never take anything personally, just do your best. And don't expect that you will never make another assumption, but you can certainly do your best. So again, he's like humanizing it, that these things are totally natural and hard to break, but doing your best at them is going to enable you to actually get to that higher place of, what is, I guess he calls it heaven, heaven on earth.
Yeah, heaven, enlightenment, and not living a hell mm-hmm. on earth. Yeah. And I can recognize that in myself. A few nights ago, I was not very impeccable with my word, and I regret it. But as he says, you should not pay for, and this is, we didn't even touch, and this is one of the intro chapters, to not continue paying for a mistake more than once. Like, you make a mistake, you learn from it, and then you move on. Like, not, like, beating yourself up for it over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to read this. I read this a little bit in the beginning of the episode, but I'll read it again in context of these lessons. So if you fall, meaning if you fall off the agreements, do not judge. Do not give your judge the satisfaction of turning you into a victim. No, be tough with yourself. Stand up and make the agreement again. Okay, I broke my agreement to be impeccable with my word. I will start all over again. I'm going to keep the four agreements just for today. Today, I will be impeccable with my word. Today, I will not take anything personally. I will not make any assumptions, and today I'm going to do my best.
Amen. Love it. So good.
So I really like that. And this book is just so small. You can keep it in your little pocket in your purse and take it with you. It's great.
So your responses to agreement number 4. The question was, what are some deeper meanings that you or lessons that you took from this chapter? And someone says, 1, put in the effort you would be proud of. And 2, no regrets equals be proud of yourself and kind to yourself after. Love that.
Yeah, I think that's a big thing, is if you try your best, even if it's not at the level of success that a society would deem it by, if you've done your best, that's good enough. It's great. This next one says, this one is very hard in our hustle society. It's kind of like the egg versus plastic balancing act. Do you know what that is? The egg versus plastic? No. I'll have to look it up. But I do agree, it's hard in our hustle society, because it's not like what your best is. It's like, how much can you physically push yourself to do, even to the point of burnout and exhaustion? And he mentions that in the chapter. He says, pushing yourself to burnout and exhaustion to the point where you're not living your life and you're balanced and happy, that's not doing your best. Mm-hmm. You know? That's
true.
Just falling into a societal trap, really.
Don't half-ass things, because that can lead to regret. If you go for something, go all in.
This one says, to always try my best, not in general, but is the best I can in the given moment.
Yes.
Perfect.
Oh my God, this is what I wanted to say before. Okay, I'll read this last one, and then I'll bring up what I forgot. It helped me to try more things, even if it's not perfect. Yeah, I like that. Like, do your best, but don't expect perfection from yourself. That's a good way to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this was the last thing that I wanted to talk about that I forgot. What I really liked, I don't remember which chapter it is, though, because now I can't find it. But how he framed, like, it's kind of dramatic. It might have been in the last chapter. But it's about, like, living as if, you know, remembering your mortality. Like, you're going to die kind of thing. Which is so, like, we've all heard it a million times. Like, live like you're dying tomorrow. Like, live like it's your last day, blah, blah, blah. But I actually heard something on TikTok recently that really, like, resonated with me and like shifted how I looked at day to day. And it was like, imagine that you already died and you right now are going back in your life and you get to relive every day. What would you do to live your life like to the most? Like, imagine you're in that position where you're already the ghost and you know that your time's already up. And in this day, you're living it as if like you're putting every last bit into it and really trying your best and like being yourself and all these things, because you know, you know, their consequences of what would happen if you didn't, kind of thing. Like, how would you live your life if it was your last day? Which I guess is the same concept, but just putting it in a different frame, I thought was so good. But he kind of says that. He says, let me find the note. Okay, yeah. The angel of death can teach us to live every day as if it's our last day of our lives, as if there are no more tomorrows. We can begin each day by saying, I'm awake. I see the sun. I'm going to give my gratitude to the sun and to everything and everyone, because I'm still alive. One more day to be myself. I love that.
Aw, that's very sweet.
The last question. Actually, we asked what your favorite or like the agreement that you found the most valuable was. And there were some, I mean, very clear answers here. The first one that got vast majority of the votes, like 4 times as many as some of the other ones, was don't take anything personally. A lot of people really resonated with that.
I think it's the one that we suffer from the most, especially as a generation that's wrapped up in social media and constantly thinking about other people's opinions with the internet. You know, I think it affects us greatly.
Totally. And then the second one after that, which has about half as many votes, is don't make assumptions, which I also agree would probably be like how I would rank them. And the last two are tied for half as many votes as that second one. And they're be impeccable with your word and always do your best. So that is the order of operations, and that's probably how I would order them, is be impeccable with your word and then always do your best would be last. But I still really like that one, and that's not to say that it was not valuable, because they all are, but it's hard to
absolutely
compare.
And they work so well together, you know, they're interchangeable. Well, I think that's about it for this episode, because Christy and I need to go eat breakfast. Not the only reason, we've also been talking for an hour and a half, and we feel like we've really kind of gone through this book, but there are actually so many things that we didn't get to go to. That's, I think, when we did our first book club, we did it in 2 episodes just because there was so much to unpack. But there, you know, there's a first chapter that's like a whole introduction to these agreements and concepts. And there's a few more chapters at the end, plus the whole intro about the Toltec wisdom. So we definitely recommend this book. You guys should check it out. And it's also pretty inexpensive. I think at Barnes Noble, it was $12, but at Target, it was like $6. So definitely check it out. And thank you so much for joining us and reading with us. We love doing book club episodes. So if you guys have a kind of like personal development, self discovery style book that you want us to do for our next book club, send us a DM or email us, which is fingerscrosspod@gmail.com, because we would love to hear your thoughts.
Yes. Thanks so much for listening and sticking with us. You can check us out on Instagram @fingerscrosspod and keep up with us there. And we'll be back next Tuesday for another episode of Fingers Crossed
of the podcast. And if you guys have been enjoying our episodes lately and our topic content and all of that, we would love if you'd write us a review on Apple Podcasts, or even update your old review if you have it, to reflect your current thoughts, because we always love to hear your opinions if you guys are enjoying the show. So yeah, just that was my little last little blurb. And other than that, I think it's time to say goodnight.
We'll see you next time. And until then,
keep your fingers crossed. Don't forget to be impeccable with your word. Don't take anything personally. Don't make assumptions, and always do your best.
Amen. Good night and goodbye.